Hi, this is Dick DiBartolo, Man's Man is trying to end the Gizwiz. Since I use weather every day, I listen to Weather Brains.
Brains, 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 brains.
I gave him a little echo for free.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
People pay a lot of money for
it's
echo.
Very professional. Very professional.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is Weather Brains. Weather Brains. A weekly show all about the weather. This is for January 22nd, 2013. Thanks to Dick DiBartolo, the Daily Giz Whiz guy. Actually, it's just the Giz Whiz. They dropped the daily part. And Leo Laporte from the Twit Network. My name is James Spann, and we just sit around the old digital mahogany table every week, and we talk weather. We're glad you're with us. And most of you listen to the audio version of this several days after we record it. But if you ever want to, we do this live Monday nights at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, and you can watch live at live.bigbrainsmedia.com. And I'm glad to say we've got a big old gaggle of weather geeks in the room tonight, including Mr. Nate Johnson of Raleigh, North Carolina.
Howdy.
So what's happening? You were at the Barron Weather Services deal, huh?
Yes. We had a good time, actually. A good group of folks. We started Friday night. This is for those who don't know what that was. Barron is one of the vendors that provides graphics and data to television stations with weather departments. They also sell a number of products to customers, and you can get it the XM Nav Weather. You get that through your car, that sort of thing. And they held a training session for all of their media clients, and I guess about 35, 40 folks there. Plus all the Barron employees. Pretty good group. We talked dual pole radar, which always makes me happy. We also talked about naming winter storms and social media, and that got James's attention. Had a pretty good weekend there. Anytime I get back to Huntsville for a couple of days was good. I met a number of folks that mentioned they listen to the show. I will not mention their names for their security, but you know who you are, and I appreciated meeting. I met a lot of folks. Really enjoyed meeting you, and thanks for listening to the show, as poor a decision as that might be.
Hey, what's scary? So I was at the AMS meeting in Austin, all right? And all these people were coming up to me saying they listened to the show, and the first thing I'm thinking of is, what is wrong with these people?
It's funny. We talk about this because my wife, every now and again, she says I'm loud. I wouldn't know anything about that. But she says she can hear me in the other room when we're on the show. And she says, why do you always say that people are crazy for listening to the show? That's not very good. Well, that's what we do. That's who we are. And it's people like, oh, I'm really glad you're on the show. And I'm thinking, I'm glad I'm doing it. I'd do it even if nobody listened, because it's a chance to chat about weather and to sort of go nuts about that for an hour and a half once a week, and to have my outlet and to hang out with you guys for a little bit. And if people listen and think it's great, then I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, this is a mismatch, that's probably the right way of saying it, of unusual people with unusual topics. And probably one of the most unusual people on the show is Kevin Sellis.
Oh, no.
Texas.
Wow. Sellis.
Kevin, what's happening out there?
I'm going to do my pick of the week now. I'm going to tell everybody to watch the first 10 minutes of this program on YouTube.
Which, by the way, you guys make fun of me. Y'all don't get to use the test pattern.
Yes.
No, you don't. Because
why?
Tonight I actually had technical difficulties. You see, let me show you. This cup here, this fantastic NC State cup. It was full of tea. Mm-hmm. Yes. Good Southern thing. Sweet tea. And right as we were getting ready to start, I was moving my light over, and I knocked it over and nearly ruined my laptop. So I had to put up the technical difficulties test pattern for a few minutes while I cleaned up the mess before my wife came downstairs and saw that I'd spilled tea all over her desk.
Uh-oh.
Hey, do you know a guy named Mark Gottfried?
I do. He's our basketball coach, and we like him very much. Thank you.
You know, he is a great guy, an old buddy. So if you see him, you tell him I said hello.
Good. I know he used to coach down at the University of Alabama, and we appreciate his services up here in Raleigh. He's done some wonderful things with our basketball team.
Over Duke, huh?
Oh, man.
What do you say? You knocked off Duke?
Heck yeah. Although I'm crying a little bit because we lost to Maryland. That wasn't very good. But we rebounded. We beat Clemson. We're playing Wake Forest. This is Monday night. We're playing Wake Forest tomorrow night. So go Wolfpack. One of the better meteorology programs out there, by the way, at NC State. Just to put a plug in.
Kevin, do you like college basketball at all?
No, I really don't pay much attention, sorry to say.
Kevin's like the old crank. I don't like basketball. I like football.
I used to pay a lot more attention to sports, and I just lost interest over the years. I don't know why.
Now we're going to talk Super. Our guest is in the Baltimore area, so we're going to talk Super Bowl here in just a second. So if you get cranky about the Super Bowl, just don't listen.
Okay.
Right? Brian Peters, you're a Florida State fan, aren't you?
I am.
How are the Seminoles doing in basketball this year? Do you know?
I don't know.
That's another team that NC State beat.
You're not much of a fan if you don't know.
Well, that's true. When it comes to basketball, I'm not much of a fan. That's all there is to it.
What sport are you a fan of, Brian?
Football.
Yeah, that's another team that NC State beat this year. Sorry, I gotta get my licks in while I can.
Boys, be nice. So, Brian, what's happening in your world?
I'm a little of this.
Wait, look at his super. Now, for those that are listening by audio, you can't see what it says. But for those watching by video, it says Colonel Sanders. Fried chicken are us. I love that. That's awesome.
I'm riding kind of high today because I had a meeting at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and I have a new client. So kind of excited about that.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
So is this for the garage cleaning business you have? What is that for?
Thank you. That's for the weather consulting for litigation.
Ah. And you want to be more specific? We're nosy. We want to know what case is this? Who you represent?
He only gets paid if somebody gets sued. That's a quality guy right there. Let me tell you. That's right.
No, it's not. It's not that I get paid if somebody gets sued. It's that I get work if somebody gets sued.
You don't even get paid. That's even worse.
So you know the problem is when you have drought, nobody sues anybody over drought.
Oh.
So now that we've had some rain, but the client, the law firm, is representing somebody whose building has been affected by wind, and it's been taking the shingles off that were supposedly guaranteed for a high wind speed.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yes,
our station. Greg and I have tossed about that idea, and we've had people email us, but management won't let us do that. I see why, but you know, I'd love to do a little bit of it.
I get these calls all the time from these people with these big, you know, outdoor venues that want you to sit out there for the insurance companies. And I always send them to Brian.
Yes, just forward them to me. Yes, as a matter of fact, I keep hoping. I did a rainfall analysis for a local company here who wanted to know the rain for Omaha, Nebraska. And I volunteered to go out there. And oh, there's Bill. I won't send you this email, Bill. I volunteered to go out there and be their rainfall observer.
Squirrel.
All right, so Bill Murray's been trying for 20 minutes to get on the show here, and he just made it. So welcome, Bill.
Well, hello, James. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Good.
I think you might be on,
you're on
the
wrong mic. You're on the wrong mic.
Wrong mic.
We're hearing some type of internal type mic there. He's got one of those fancy mics. What kind of mic is that? Does he have here?
You know what you need, Bill,
it's
an electro voice, yes.
Please stand much by better. Technical difficulties slate to put up while you're doing that. But
I know. It's been a horrible night. I had to reinstall the plug-in. And after night, Scott and I practiced on Saturday, too, and it worked perfectly.
Well, Bill, let's let you bring in Scott because he has been sitting here through 30 minutes of foolishness. And the fact that the guy is still here speaks volumes about the man's character.
Yeah, you just thought your book club was going to be tough, Scott.
I know.
Certainly a bigger challenge than that. Well, our friend Scott Braun was a guest suggestion from one of our listeners several months ago, and he's here to talk about those incredible, you know, unmanned vehicles that they've been flying into hurricanes. So, Scott, welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks. And who was it that suggested that? I want names.
Names have been changed to protect the innocent and the guilty.
We don't disclose those anymore. We stopped doing that a long time ago. But anyway, we're glad you stuck around tonight and joined us. But Scott, talk for a second about what the project is that you're working on at NASA.
All right. Well, we're working on a project called the Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel. It's a NASA-funded mission over 5 years to use unmanned aircraft to study hurricanes, how they form and how they intensify. The aircraft we're using is the Global Hawk. For those of you who are familiar with aircraft, these are like the granddaddies of the unmanned aircraft. About 116-foot wingspan, 43 feet long, can fly up to about 30 hours and up to about 65,000 feet. So it allows you to get above the storms and then stay out over the storms for much longer than what you can do with manned aircraft.
So now, in the project that y'all are working on right now, how long has it been going on, Scott, and how long will it continue?
Well, the project first got started back in 2010, but we didn't have our first deployment until this past hurricane season, 2012. Took about a year and a half or so to kind of get all the logistics taken care of, do all the planning, and since I work for government, write all the documentations, do all the reviews and all that fun stuff as well. So we just had our first deployment. We'll be doing two more each of the next two hurricane seasons, about 5 weeks in the field each time. That allows us to do maybe 10 or 11 flights during that time, assuming things are active.
So you're the principal investigator on this, right?
Right.
On this project. Tell me what the goal of the project is.
Well, and most of you guys know that the track forecasts have improved over the years, but intensity forecasts for storms hasn't seen a whole lot of improvement. So we're trying to not necessarily improve the forecast directly, but just to get a better understanding of how these storms work, how they form, what are the processes behind intensification. In particular, how much of that is governed by the environment versus the inner core working, such as processes in the eye wall and the rain bands. And so we're basically using a sustained measurement campaign to collect observations in ways that haven't been done before to try to address those questions. Part of that is looking at just analyzing the data. Part of it's also getting the data into numerical models to see whether, in terms of what's called data assimilation, we can have an impact on forecasts, at least retrospective forecasts.
So, Scott, do you get a full parameter, a full suite of parameters of data, when you're studying the storms, or are you limited into what you can collect?
We're getting a broad suite of information, but you're always limited by what you can get via aircraft, particularly when you're doing it through remote sensing rather than direct measurements. So on our environmental aircraft, we're measuring, we have a drop zone system, so we're getting profiles for temperature, humidity, and winds. We have an interferometer sounder. If you're familiar with geosynchronous sounders, this is like an even more impressive type of IR sounder that gets temperature and humidity profiles. Fairly coarse vertical resolution, but we get very high resolution in the horizontal. We have a cloud physics LIDAR, which is a laser that gives us accurate information on the cloud tops and for thinner cirrus, some of the cloud structure. But the main reason that we have that instrument is to be able to track Saharan dust, because one of the key problems that we're looking at, which is relevant to the Atlantic, is the role of the Saharan air layer in terms of either favoring or suppressing storm development in the Atlantic. On our overstorm aircraft, the second aircraft that we have a Doppler radar to get three-dimensional wind and precipitation, a microwave sounder to get temperature and humidity, again, with sort of coarse vertical resolution, but high horizontal resolution. And then we have I don't know if you're familiar with what the hurricane hunters often use. They have something called a step frequency microwave radiometer. And basically, below the flight track, they get estimates of the surface wind and rain. But it only gives you like a line of data. We have one that does cross-track scanning, so you're actually getting a broad swath, maybe 70 kilometers across. So within one crossing of a storm, you can map out the whole horizontal wind speed field. So it's a big advance over what's being done on the NOAA and Air Force aircraft right now. But it's still a new technology, so it still needs to be fully checked out and proven.
Now, is that something that would eventually make it over to the manned aircraft program, or is this a situation where this might eventually replace the manned aircraft program, Scott?
Well, this particular instrument, I mean, if you put it on a manned aircraft, the swath will be much narrower, because the reason we can get a 70-kilometer swath is because we're flying up at 60,000 feet, considerably higher than what manned aircraft would be at. So if, as you come down, you're going to shrink that the swath width. And then as far as the unmanned aircraft replacing manned aircraft, it's probably not likely. It's a fairly expensive venture. And there are a number of challenges with using the unmanned aircraft, particularly something like the Global Hawk. You know, if you imagine something like the NOAA P3, they can sometimes, with multiple crews, do two flights a day. So they can, you know, send the plane out, come back, switch crews, send it back out. We can do one flight for, say, 30 hours. But then we bring the plane back, we're down for 24 hours with one aircraft, because it takes a long time to refuel, prep the aircraft again, and then get it back out. So we're always going to have these bigger data gaps. But when we are out there, we'll be out there for 2 to 3 times as long. So it's very complementary to what's being done with the manned aircraft. But I don't think it will fully replace it. I think there's something to be said about having the manned aircraft. They're also flying down lower, getting direct measurements, particularly you know, the in-situ winds. They can target their sondes maybe a little bit better than we can, although we're getting pretty good at being able to target things to some extent. We hope with some of the technologies that we want to use in the future that we could really overload the storms with the drop sondes, maybe drop you know, up to 30 to 50 sons at one time into a storm, if everything works out in one of the upcoming years. So that would be a new test for us to see if that can be done. It's almost sort of the Twister idea. If you remember in Twister, when they had those instruments flying up, I mean, we can envision flying over a storm and just dropping out like 20 sons and then coming across, dropping out another 20 and letting those things float down to the surface. You know, you're just mapping out the wind field in a way that's pretty incredible. The technology's almost getting to the point of being able to do that, but we're probably still a little ways from doing that.
And now, how many sons can your aircraft carry in one mission, Scott?
We can do about, I think the number is 88 in one flight.
Wow.
The most that we've done is 76. We did in one of our flights of Hurricane Nadine last year.
So if you got them, you use them, huh?
You got to try, yeah. We paid for them, we might as well use them. Nobody else is going to use them.
If you're flying at 60,000 feet, that's got to be considerably higher than even the Gulfstream plane can fly. Is that true?
Yeah, the Gulfstream 4 is typically flying around 42 to 45,000 feet. So they're getting up into the outflow layer a bit. We're getting up above the outflow layer. So with these sondes, we're getting everything from the stratosphere down through the entire outflow layer down to the surface. One of the things we want to really understand is what the advantage is of getting the full resolution of that outflow layer. And there's a number of people think that the outflow layer is a critical part of what allows storms to develop. But if you have inadequate measurements of that outflow layer, you know, that may be a key limitation on forecasting. So we want to go with some of the numerical experiments that we're going to be doing, really evaluate what the added value is of getting the full resolution of the outflow layer and the winds within that layer, and see if that has a big impact on the forecast.
So do you have a hunch that there might be some secrets hiding there in the outflow that might help you with your eventual findings here?
I think so. I think we're already starting to see some interesting structures in terms of the wind structure within the outflow layer. When you think about how a storm interacts with its environment, particularly with an upstream trough and the wind shear associated with that trough, I mean, sometimes you may have heard of a good trough, bad trough. Some troughs that are approaching a storm actually help to intensify it. Some will act to weaken it. We can, by looking at that upper level outflow layer and being able to cover a large area, we could potentially look at the interactions between the trough and the outflow layer more directly and see to what extent there is an interaction there. Now, most of that will be done by coupling those observations with the numerical models. Although by the observations themselves, it's difficult to evaluate, but the modeling is really going to be a key part of that.
I think you said you only are going to fly a couple of missions in this, or a couple of storms in a season. What's a perfect storm for you guys?
We'll fly as many as occur during our 4 to 5 week deployment. It really depends on which targets look most attractive to us. I'd say the storms that give the most difficulty with forecasting are the ones that either rapidly intensify or rapidly weaken. And so those are always going to be our highest priority. Of course, if there's a Sandy approaching the coast, we'll more than likely send an aircraft out there, even if there's one that might be a higher scientific value for us in terms of rapid intensification. If there's something bearing down on the coast, we'll try to our best to look at that as well. But the ideal storm for us is something that that we expect to undergo rapid intensification, but there's uncertainty about when, and we want to just cover a period of several days to look at what sets off the initial onset of that rapid intensification using our environmental aircraft, and then with the overstorm aircraft that has the radar on it, really being able to map out the winds and precipitation within the storms to see what's happening more on the smaller scales.
So now these really cool aircraft that you guys are flying, where are they based, and where are the controllers when they're flying them?
Well, the NASA Global Hawks are based at our Dryden Flight Research Center, which is located on Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California. And most of the time they're flown from that location. We have an operations center there. And up until about 2011, that was the only place where we could fly them. That was our only control center. Back in 2011, NASA built some portable trailers that basically mimic that control center so that we could take the aircraft anywhere. And that's what we did in 2012 with our first deployment, as we flew out of NASA's Wallops flight facility in Virginia using those portable trailers. And NASA is currently building another operations center at Wallops that would be a permanent station so that those trailers could be used anywhere else. There's an experiment going on right now using one of the Global Hawks to look at the tropical transition layer. Right now they're flying out of Dryden, but in future years they expect to fly out of Guam and maybe even Darwin, Australia. So that we have the potential to eventually be able to fly out of anywhere where the weather is cooperative in terms of being able to take off and land.
Yeah, I want to follow that one, Bill, if I can, because I was interested in that, too. You said it had a 30-hour flight time, Scott?
Right.
So flying from Edwards or even Wallops Island, that's chewing up a bunch of time just getting there.
Actually, you'd be surprised. Flying from Wallops, we can get to a storm pretty quick. If you're trying to get down to the Gulf, it's a little slow compared to, say, flying out of Florida. But what we can do is we just go right down the coast, cross northern Florida into the Gulf. When it comes to trying to catch storms in the central Atlantic or the eastern Atlantic, it's actually faster out of Wallops than out of Florida, because we can fly a great circle route to it, and you get there a little bit faster.
Is there interest in going out further into the Atlantic, well east of the Caribbean?
Oh, absolutely. When we flew Nadine last year, we picked it up when it first became a tropical storm out in the central Atlantic, and then followed it. Actually, we did three flights in the later stages of Nadine when it was hovering around the Azores. Now, try flying an aircraft out of Florida out to the Azores. Spending, it takes you several hours to get there, to say the least. I think it normally took us about 8 hours to get to the storm. We'd fly it for 10 hours and then fly 8 hours back.
Is there some chance you could go from the Windward Islands at some point?
If we were to try and deploy there, if we brought the trailers out there and the runways were adequate, we could do it. The one risk you have is that if a storm were to approach the Windward Islands and it was likely to be hurricane strength, we would probably then have to evacuate the aircraft back to California and then start all over again. And then once the storm has passed, bring them back. So one of the reasons for choosing Wallops was that Storm Sandy aside, it's normally an area that's not going to get hit hard by hurricanes. So it's a place where we can operate fairly safely unless we have a storm that's running up the coast, like Sandy or an Irene or something like that. But climatologically speaking, it's not that common compared to, say, basing in Florida or on the Gulf Coast or something like that, where there's maybe a higher percentage of a landfall.
I assume they're largely autopilot, but somebody's got to be on the stick at some point, yes?
We have a pilot and a co-pilot flying at all, well, they're there at all times. So what you do is you program the initial route, and it's all done by programming a series of waypoints. And the pilots let it fly to those waypoints. But at any time, they can take over and assign new waypoints if you want to change the track. But even then, the aircraft is flying on its own. But so the role of the pilot is always to create new waypoints. If you want to break off a given line of flight and get to a particular part of the storm, what he does is he just, using a computer mouse, creates a whole new series of waypoints that then the aircraft flies to. So there is a pilot there at all times, but at all times the plane is flying on its own.
And are you saying wave, W-A-V-E point?
No, way as in W-A-Y.
Oh, okay, I got you. Well, that's fascinating. I'm very intrigued.
Yeah, this is some really cool stuff, Scott. And I guess you can't really fly penetrations into the center like Brian Peters, our guy, has done several times when he's flown on hurricane missions. I guess you leave those to the bigger planes, huh?
Well, it's not so much the size of the plane. It's just the Global Hawk was built for flying at higher altitude and was not intended to fly into turbulent conditions. It's got a very long wingspan, and in turbulent conditions, you risk basically breaking off the wings, probably.
Brian has that problem, too.
Absolutely. I kept my eyes on those wings all the time. They did flap a little bit.
Oh, they flap quite a bit. I've been on a DC-8 through storms, and you can watch those things flap quite a bit. These would do some... Basically, the Global Hawk is just a glider with a big engine on it. And so those wings wouldn't do too well in turbulent conditions. And that's one of the big things that we have to be careful about when flying it, when flying directly over the storm, is the pilots are always concerned about turbulence above the storm. Turbulence that you can get from deep convection that's punching on the tropopause and creating gravity waves above. So we're always on the lookout for deep convection. When we see cloud top temperatures getting below, say, minus 70 degrees Celsius, meaning you're basically getting up to the tropopause, then we have to evaluate whether we need to deviate the aircraft around that convection in the event that there might be some turbulence. It's not quite clear how often turbulence occurs up there. The one thing we can say is that in past experiments, when we flew the NASA ER-2 aircraft, which is an old U-2 spy plane type of aircraft, we flew it over Hurricane. Well, our pilot flew it over Hurricane Emily back in 2005, and he encountered such strong turbulence that it almost brought the aircraft down. So ever since then, they've been very cautious about trying to fly these high altitude aircraft above these storms.
So now, does any of the data that's been collected so far, has it made it directly into the models in real time, or is this all just research right now, Scott?
We've had a couple centers use the DropSon data so far. The ECMWF and the U.S. Navy have used the DropSons. NOAA NSEP has not used them so far because they want to get a better understanding of the error characteristics of the DropSon data before they put it into their assimilation system. But what we're trying to do at this point is to at least get the data out to, say, the National Hurricane Center so that they can look at the data and evaluate it and determine to what extent it's useful for them. And this past year, we only had our environmental aircraft, so the only data off of that they were really interested in was the DropSon data. Next year, we expect to have both aircraft, and we're hoping to get some of the real-time data from the Doppler radar and from the microwave radiometer that's similar to the step frequency microwave radiometer. Hopefully, we can get that to them in real time and, you know, get some feedback from them as to whether or not it's useful. I think it'll certainly be useful in terms of getting a good center fix with fairly high accuracy. They're going to want to compare the microwave radiometer data to the SFMR to just make sure they're getting consistent wind speeds. But once they get a level of trust with that, we hope that they'll make ready use of it.
Now, you mentioned a pilot and a co-pilot that are actively, you know, they're flying the plane remotely. What about meteorologists? How many meteorologists are involved, Scott?
But, you know, to operate this aircraft and for our science operations as well, we probably have a group that's on the order of 15 people. So you've got the pilot, the co-pilot, a mission manager, a safety guy, and there's one other from the basically the equivalent to the cockpit. In our back room, we have a payload manager, a mission scientist, someone like me who's basically monitoring things, looking at the data, and then, you know, to the pilot's consternation, always asking them to do something different or interesting. And then we have one or two people manning computers, monitoring all the different instruments, the meteorological instruments. So in the end, we have a pretty good sized group there. And not only do we have that many, but we have to have three shifts of that many people, because for a 26-hour flight, which is what we typically do, you know, you can only have, you have to do it. If you're only doing one flight every week, you might be able to have just two crews doing it and just work a long day. But if you're potentially doing back to as close as you can get to back to back flights, you need three crews. And so we have, it's a pretty big operation for us, a lot of people involved.
So I guess when Colonel Duckworth flew that first mission into that hurricane in 1943 off of Galveston, he had no idea what he was starting, did he?
Yeah, and little did he realize he'd get replaced by someone on the ground.
He probably would have passed out if you'd have told him that in 1943. Now, so your background is computer modeling, I understand, Scott. So I guess this is a boon for you to see all this data. And what do you envision doing with it on the modeling side?
My background, actually, I've done everything from strictly observational work to doing the computer modeling. Now I'm actually back more on the observational side. But we're really interested in analyzing the data to look at the structure of the storms that we're seeing in terms of the inner core structure as well as the environment. Right now, I'm primarily looking at the environmental data for Nadine, which was the main storm that we observed last year. You know, for those of you who followed the storm season last year, Nadine was sort of the only storm that occurred in throughout much of September, and it was the one that just didn't want to die. It was around for, I think it was like 24 days, something like that, and just kind of hovered out there. And it was in an area that's pretty atypical for hurricanes cold sea surface temperatures, most of the time fairly strong vertical wind shear, and yet this thing kept going. So we want to better understand why the storm was able to survive as long as it did. The remarkable thing was that despite the fact that it had strong wind shear, which normally would rip storms apart, this thing had a well-defined warm core up to about 300 millibars to about every flight that we did when it was hovering around the Azores. And then the remarkable thing was that despite the fact that the sea surface temperatures didn't change much, shear for the most part remained fairly high, although there were a couple of lulls. This thing redeveloped into a hurricane and reached its maximum intensity overall toward the very end when it was over 26 degree water or so. So there's a lot of interesting things about what was going on in that storm and why it was able to survive and then why it re-intensified despite being over relatively cool water still. So that's what our focus is on right now, is just trying to better understand that storm. But we have a big team looking at the data. We have a number of people looking at the observations. We have colleagues from the Navy at the Naval Research Lab in Monterey who are doing some modeling experiments, in particular looking at the impact of the drops-on data. And right now they've shown that, at least in their forecast system, the drops-ons had a very positive influence on the forecast. But what we want to do is then withhold the data, say, from the upper levels versus mid or lower levels and see, well, what levels is the biggest impact coming from? And then is it mostly coming from the wind data, temperature data, or humidity data? So we want to just get a better sense of where the impact is and what information is most impactful.
So as you continue along in this process and you learn more and more about what's going on, you know, where does the project go after this? You know, what do you think the next big breakthrough is going to be?
Well, that's a tough call there. You know, NOAA is very interested in trying to use one of the Global Hawks operationally. They're talking with NASA about trying to be able to use one of the NASA aircraft on a regular basis. NASA actually has five of these aircraft right now. two of which are science capable, two are just sitting on the ground, need a lot of work before they can be made science ready, and the last one is basically spare parts. The main reason being that these are old. The ones that we're using are like the first line of Global Hawks ever built. Our Overstorm aircraft is actually the very first model of the Global Hawk. And the other one we're using is the sixth model, and the one for spare parts is the seventh. So anyway, kind of off on a tangent there. NOAA's interested in doing that. We're actually interested in trying to take it to the Pacific and looking at West Pacific storms. The Navy is very interested in that because they have a lot of assets in the field there. And we're basically putting a proposal together to try to bring it out to the Pacific and do a bigger experiment out there where we have the NASA Global Hawks and maybe some of the Navy aircraft as well and do a much bigger experiment. The West Pacific poses some major challenges, the biggest one being that because of the warmer ocean temperatures out there, the storms tend to be much deeper. Yeah, we typically don't like to fly anything over about 50,000 feet, and just a quick climatology that we did recently suggests that cloud tops out there probably run 54,000 feet, maybe even higher. So that's going to be a real challenge to get the aircraft over storms. Finding a base of operations is also a challenge. We've been looking at Guam, but Guam doesn't always have the best weather during summer, and is not the may not be the easiest place to operate out of. So we're looking at our options there. So in terms of hurricanes, that's what we're looking at. But these aircraft can be used for a number of other things. Other groups are looking at using them for winter storm research on the West Coast. It could be used for looking at polar climate and other things like that. So there's a number of applications for these aircraft.
Scott, you said you're doing mostly high-level stuff. Is there some interest and or value to trying to get one into an eye and staying in there for a little while?
Well, we can't fly in that sense, like the NOAA P-3 or C-130, because we're up high and we can't fly down low. But we can get out over an eye, and because we're flying at fairly high altitudes, I have to see what our turn radius is and whether we can really just hover over the eye. But for our instruments, that's not really ideal. So what we would typically do is a figure four pattern where you would set it up to do repeated crossings. And you can make those legs short enough that you can have a crossing of the eye, say, every half hour or something like that, or maybe a little bit shorter. So even though you're not there continuously, it's a pretty frequent revisit.
Now, Scott, in this day of all sorts of challenges, obviously the fiscal cliff is a challenge always. And in this day of funding, what do you think is going to go on there with projects like this?
That's a good question. For our project, I think we're far enough along. I don't think we would see any cuts. More than likely, if NASA's budget gets cut, what you'll see is future projects either be delayed or canceled. So as I said, we're working on a proposal now to take these aircraft out to the West Pacific. That proposal will be submitted this coming year. But if the budget got cut, there's always the possibility that projects like that simply get shifted maybe 6 months to a year down the line to try to spread the projects out a bit more. Or some projects will just get canceled outright if the budget situation looked bad for the long term. So it's still a little hard to say right now. A lot of these programs, the program that our campaign is funded under is called Earth Venture, and there's a whole series of these Earth Venture campaigns, and from my understanding is that those are funded at the moment, so even if there's a cut now, those projects would probably move forward, those opportunities, but further down the line we'll have to see.
Hey, Scott, forget all this science stuff. Who do you like in the Super Bowl? You like the 49ers or do you like the Ravens?
Well, I grew up in the San Francisco area, but I have to say I was a Raider fan growing up there because I lived closer to Oakland, so I was never a 49er fan. The challenge I've always had was I've lived in a lot of AFC West towns, Seattle, Denver. It was kind of nice moving to the East Coast where I didn't have to worry about that. Started rooting for the Redskins, but now I root for the Ravens mostly, so I'm definitely rooting for the Ravens on this one. I became a big fan of theirs back in about 99 or so. Is that too long of an answer?
You heard it here.
That's a good answer.
Go Ravens. That's all. I'll just say that.
No, you're an analytical guy. You're all over it. There you go.
I mean, and he's got like all those computer models, too, he can play with.
That's right.
Well, the funny thing is my old professor is still at San Francisco State. That's where I went to school. And so he's a big 49er fan. So he and I don't have a bet yet, but I'm sure we'll have one by the end of the week.
I think Flacco, man, this guy's got a great arm. I mean, he's good. So
he can be good until he makes you unhappy.
That's kind of the way it works in the weather business, too.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Scott, if anybody is interested in maybe learning more about your work and what you guys do, what's a good way of getting in touch with you?
You can look at the best way probably is through our webpage for the project. It's ESPO.NASA.gov/HS3. That's the project webpage, and our contact information is on there. You can also
Are you on Twitter?
No.
Wait, you're not on Twitter?
No.
Kevin, you want to be happy? Kevin, you want to be happy? We found a guy that's not on Twitter.
I refuse Scott and I are to the, tweet.
Scott and I are the smartest guys on this program.
That's right.
All right. Well, listen, Scott, thanks. I know that it's late. Thanks a lot for taking the time to come on the show this week. Your work is great. On behalf of us operational guys, we cannot thank you enough for the work you're doing. So thanks a lot for being on the show, and hope you have a great week.
Thanks, Scott.
Really interesting.
Okay, thanks a lot. We will talk to you later. And what we're going to do right now is pause. We've got Weather Brains 101, Bill Murray, with a live version of This Week in Weather History. We have the weather roundup. We have the picks of the week. We have the fog bank. We have the email inbox and much more as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
The first of the new dual polarization products we're going to examine on Weather Brains 101 is differential reflectivity, also known as ZDR. A dual polarization radar sends out both a vertically oriented and a horizontally oriented pulse. Differential reflectivity measures the difference between these pulses. In general, if ZDR is near zero, it means the difference is small, so the echoes are more spherical in shape. As ZDR becomes increasingly positive, the hydrometeor is more dominantly horizontal. Conversely, as ZDR becomes increasingly negative, the hydrometeor is more dominantly vertical. Now, ZDR values can range from minus 8 to plus 8, though values rarely get that extreme on either side. In a rain situation, as ZDR increases, drop size increases. So a ZDR value over 3 is indicative of big drops. Hail, though, is usually not spherical in shape, but it actually appears that way to the radar, so ZDR values drop to near zero. However, if hail is small and or it's coated with water, ZDR values will usually be high with readings at 5 or 6. This hail will almost never be severe in size by the time it reaches the surface. Conversely, negative ZDR values can be indicative of very large hail. For snow and ice situations, ZDR can vary significantly. Generally, dry snow is closer to a zero ZDR value, while wet snow will increase in value. And when it comes to non-weather returns, they can have ZDR values all over the scale. Now, ZDR is used primarily for the identification of hail, for help in identifying the melting layer, for updraft detection, for those transition zones for changes in precipitation, and for tornado debris detection. In our next episode, we'll move on to a description of CC, or correlation coefficient. We can help you with your weather questions if you drop a note to question@weatherbrains.com.
It's time now for This Week in Weather History, and I betcha, Bill is going to talk about the cold wave of 1985.
I'm going to actually talk about the January thaw, James, kind of the polar opposite of what you were talking about. We can talk about the 1985 cold wave, which will be a lot of fun.
Because, you know, tomorrow morning, on the 22nd, in my market in Birmingham, it was 6 below zero. in 1985. But at that time, I was in Dallas-Fort Worth, and I missed out. But go ahead. The time now for This Week in Weather History, the live version with Bill Murray.
Yeah, the January thaw, James, is a weather singularity. You know, singularity is an event that occurs more often than one would expect with chance. Now, the January thaw is a period of above-normal warmth that frequently occurs in midwinter in the northeastern and U.S. and eastern Canada, similar to Indian summer, which is another singularity that occurs in autumn. The January thaw usually occurs around the third week in January. But in 1950, it was more like a January tropical heat wave than a thaw. Much of the eastern U.S. was experiencing temperatures 25 to 35 degrees above normal by my birthday, January 25th. Of course, I hadn't been born then. But cotton was blooming in South Carolina some 5 months ahead of schedule. People thought that Mother Nature had gone berserk and was out of control. In actuality, a strong high-pressure system off the Atlantic coast was responsible for the 1950 January thaw. A very high amplitude pattern followed a big ridge over the east, a deep trough over the west, and the strong surface high was producing a strong southerly flow that bathed much of the eastern U.S. in warmth. On the 25th, it was 87 in Del Rio, Texas, 83 in Little Rock, 78 in Nashville, 74 in Columbus, Ohio, 78 in the nation's capital, and 80 in Augusta, Georgia. Here we are, where we are in Birmingham, it was 78 degrees and 80 degrees in Montgomery. Birmingham had record highs on the 24th, the 25th, and the 26th, with 78, 78, and 76 degrees, respectively. Now, several January all-time high temperature records were set, including Michigan with 72 at Ann Arbor, and Chicago with 67. Meanwhile, it was bitterly cold in the west, the northern plains. Morning lows on the 25th included 34 below zero at Williston and 32 below zero at Glasgow, Montana. Now, there's no truth to the rumor that James sounded the global warming buzzer from his baby bed during this week in weather history.
All right. So JB is not on the show, but I understand, Bill, you got a copy.
Yeah, his internet was down. And I don't know how he emailed me this, but we couldn't get his computer to work. But anyway, and I have fresh baked cookies that Sally just brought me, and I just dropped one on the floor. But anyway, figured I need to get credit for that. But yeah, he sent this over, and it's really good. He said extremes today, 86 degrees at Fullerton, California, minus 29 this morning at Babbitt, Minnesota. It was minus 18 in Inaktivuk, Alaska, if anybody can tell me if I pronounced that correctly or not.
Gesundheit.
Close enough.
I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure JB would have gotten it right. But he says there's 35 inches of snow at Valdez. At Chicago, the main airport, only 4/10 of an inch of snow this month. And Chicago, only 1.3 inches of snow this season, which is way less than what Birmingham has gotten with the 2 inches we picked up last week, he says. And International Falls, the high today was minus 12. The low this morning was minus 24. They've got 14 inches of snow on the ground. And he commented on the fast-moving snow showers that moved through Cincinnati today, caused numerous wrecks on the interstates and at least one fatality. North Dakota, the ground is frozen to a depth of 20 inches over most of the state. And Denver today had a high of 56 degrees, which represented a 40-degree warm-up from the weekend. Alta, Utah, 49 inches of snow on the ground. And that's a ski area in the Wasatch Mountains that JB just loves. And, James, that's it.
I was driving down the highway today and saw a car pass me with a bumper sticker, and it said, "Honk if you had more snow than Chicago this season."
No way.
Now, they've had like less than 1 inch. It's been a snow drought. All right. Well, I tell you what here. Let's... I love the email segment. It's got to be my favorite segment of the show, so it's that time.
Take that, Kevin Selly. Take that, Kevin Selly. Ha ha. All right, let's.
Is it his favorite over the last 6 or 7 months, or over the course of the program, over the 6 years?
I think over the last 5 months.
That's what I figured. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's dig in here and take a look at the old email inbox. Let's see.
And by the way, I've got that audio
from last week. Good.
So if you I've got the WCCO. So if you need any of that, I've got it.
Okay.
Here.
Well, roll the email from our friend in Estonia.
Here we go.
Hello, Weather Brains. This is Darmo Danielso, Weather Brains fan from Laguia, Estonia. in light of recent repeated suggestions that the show should be more like the NPR, I'm at least trying to do this clip with my NPR voice. But I have some news for you.
We can update this episode of Weather Brains for an important news bulletin.
As cranky as I am, I, for one, welcome our choking overlords. Keep up the good work.
We appreciate that, Tarmo, and also want to say that he sent us a clip of a 1984. See, my email's being slow here. It's not a clip, but an article about in the Electronic Journal of Severe Storms Meteorology about a Russian tornado outbreak in 1984. We'll throw a link to that on the old webpage there.
I don't think my email was ever slow, just saying.
Well, yeah, but my email's more interesting. So I got a Weather Brains listener survey response. We're getting a lot more of these now that I'm doing email. So I appreciate these coming along here. One from Catherine Newton in the Birmingham Eagle Point area. We appreciate your listening to the program. Also have one from Daniel Brown. It's from Trustville. And let's see. He's got an interesting story. He's been a weather geek from back in 1979 when one James Spann spoke to his kindergarten class. Unlike Dan from last week, he thinks the show is an excellent mix of humor and information, and he would like to hear an intelligent discussion of climate change issues, although it sounds like he's already made up his mind and thinks that it is a hoax. So there we go. Another one from Michelle, and she's in Asheville. Again, Asheville with only one E at the end. The Asheville in North Carolina has two E's, A-S-H-E-V-I-L-L-E.
But they're not at the end.
No, they're not. The one of them's in the middle and one is at the end. See, Michelle also thinks that joking around is a good thing. She appreciates the humor. Her hometown, the Asheville Shoal Creek tornado, missed her home by barely a quarter of a mile. So, scary stuff. And that's pretty much all the commentary there, but we appreciate that. Another one from Cameron Williams. I love these. These are great.
You're making them up now.
Yeah. Oh, Rogersville, Alabama. This guy stumbled upon James's Facebook fan page and followed the post to the Alabama Weather blog and then found his way here. It's a lot of work to get to this thing, and I hope you found it's worth it, although the rest of us don't. Heard people mention that a high pressure inversion is the reason for some abnormal weather in the Northwest. Abnormal is in Lake McDonald at Glacier National Park not freezing over again this winter. What exactly is a high pressure inversion, and has it incurred often in the past? So maybe a future Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters coming there. So we'll throw that into the hopper. We appreciate that. A couple of suggestions for guests for the program. One from our friend David Phillips, and he's suggesting that we get Andrew Kozak, forgive the name if I botch that, Andrew, but if you haven't seen the clip, this is a fellow in Tulsa whose weather graphics machine, he does a morning show, and his weather graphics computer croaked on him before he was able to go onto the air, and so he took a set of Sharpies and colored markers, and did the weather graphics the old, old-fashioned way. We're talking not even Tim Russert old, actually sheets of paper. Did a really good job. Even got the sponsor logo up on the top of the 7 days. Twitter and Facebook handles at the bottom. Really nicely done. So I'd love to have him on. Maybe, Kevin, he could be a guest or Weather Brain panelist, since that seems to be your thing.
Shouldn't somebody's still got to be using magnetic board. Somebody somewhere. Wouldn't that be cool to revive that just for fun on a morning show or something?
I think, Kevin, you ought to start that over at Belo Broadcasting tonight on your next weather segment.
Well,
there's so many Belo comments I wanted to make, but they just put out a social media policy the other week, so I think I'd be fired in about 10 seconds.
The first rule about the social media policy is not to talk about the social media.
Don't talk about the policy or the company. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Another set of guest suggestions from Rick Bennett, suggesting that we need more Northeast and Mid-Atlantic representation on his show. Suggests we chase down a former WRAL and current Philadelphia meteorologist Glenn Hurricane Wayne Schwartz. He'd be a hoot on this program. Adam Joseph from ABC 6 and Mike Masco. I believe he's from either Baltimore or somewhere. Seen a lot of his stuff on Facebook, especially during Sandy. Really good use, I think, in the medium. Would love to have him on. And again, since that's more of a social media thing, Kevin Selling, I'm going to make work for you since you're not doing anything otherwise.
No.
I'm not busy making Texas waffles.
Hey, now. Jonathan Thompson emails us to say that Goodbye Vienna, which we referred to on last week's program, was not Ringo Starr. It was Billy Joel.
Who said it was Ringo Starr? I haven't listened to the show yet.
That wasn't me. I'm going to blame that on James.
Yeah, sure.
I can't believe you missed that one, James.
See, we got an email from Michael Potts talking about, I don't know if you saw this today, but very similar sort of thing. Of course, I was in Alabama this past weekend, and with a little shot of snow that we saw in North Alabama, this is Thursday afternoon, a little spot south of Huntsville and Coleman got almost 6 inches of snow in a very short amount of time. Parts of I-65 were closed down for more than 12 hours, folks stranded overnight. Something similar happened today in the Cincinnati area, except it just caused a bunch of accidents out with some flurries and whatnot. Fortunately, we didn't have a whole lot of issues there, but I hope everybody is okay about that. And since James is yawning, finally, we're going to talk about food. John
this is
Huntington.
I always yawn.
John, I don't think he ever yawned during my email segment, but I'm just...
Oh, please.
John Huntington, Johnny is really just it's a response to grab for air, and I'm just leaving him breathless with all this good content. Oh. And it's getting deep in here, isn't it, right?
Really?
And yeah. John Huntington from Brooklyn sent us a note about a XKCD comic. If you don't follow XKCD, it's good stuff, and he posted one. He's doing a Wise segment on Tuesday where you're answering questions, and one last week was about how far up would you have to drop a steak from to get it to cook in the friction of the atmosphere. Pretty cool stuff. And that is it for this week. I've got a couple of other ones in here. We'll save those for next week because we might be able to get into a discussion about those. So that is it for this week's email inbox. Send us an email if you want to get us in touch or get in touch with us. Email at weatherbrains.com. You might hear your email read live on the podcast, and in which case your anonymity as a Weather Brains listener and any innocence that would attain thereto gets shot. You're responsible for the... It's all yours.
All right. Let's roll that fog bank. Time for Picks of the Week. We'll start it off with Skydaver.
Hello, Weather Brains listeners. This is Dave Phillips, Skydaver on Twitter. Let's get started. First up, NOAA Weather Partners has a bite-sized video out about the MPing smartphone app. If you're a Weather Brains listener, you should be part of MPing. Last week, during the rain and snowstorm, MPing lit up all over the East Coast. From Space Weather, a photo of aurora streams taken from satellite. My third pick is from the Earth Science Picture of the Day with a great photo of some iridescent clouds above Alberta, Canada. Got another great aurora picture that was taken on January 15th. And finally, Anderson Cooper featured KTUL meteorologist Andrew Kozak when his computer graphics program went down while he was trying to do the weather. We need to get Andrew on Weather Brains. Thanks for listening. Skydaver out.
Didn't I already say that?
Yep.
Yeah, you did. This guy is at KTUL. He works for my company then.
Oh.
He's part of the family.
You know, it's funny about the social media aspect of this, because this what he did has happened before. I've seen it, but it was able to go viral now. And he's gotten a lot of traction out of it.
Well, and he did a really nice job. And it wasn't like
he
threw it together. I mean, you know, it sort of makes you wonder how much time he had, because that's not the kind of thing that you whip together in the commercial break between when your machine crashes and when you have to be on the air. Having said that, nothing to diminish from that. That was a pretty slick work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's do Picks of the Week. I will start with my pick, and you're seeing it up on the screen right now. The National Operational Hydrologic Remote Sensing Center, which is easy for me to say. Goodness. The Interactive Snow Information Site.
Ooh.
This thing's actually pretty cool. You can just kind of zoom in and take a look at the data, and it's actually very good. So it is that time of the year If you'd like snow information, model snow water equivalent forecasted for certain times, we'll put the link up on weatherbrains.com. So, Kev, do you, sir, have a pick for us this week?
Yes, sir. It is a recent post on the Digital Meteorologist blog. It's mainly for the broadcasters, but it does kind of signal to anybody about the change with digital media and the internet and all that kind of stuff. It's fairly short, but it's kind of an interesting story. I won't tell it here, but I will say make sure that you read and understand the addendum, because when I first posted it, a number of comments went by that were perfectly valid, but not necessarily to the point that I was making, and you can find that at weatherbrains.com.
All right, sounds good. Brian Peters, the internationally beloved meteorologist, what's your pick?
My pick is the foghorn.
Oh.
Wow. But I have an announcement.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. No, it's good. What do you mean, uh-oh?
Well, I don't know. You could be announcing that you're leaving or something, and that would be bad.
Are you kidding me? Well, actually, I probably will be leaving you for 2 weeks, but I'm trying to establish a goal for mid-June to do my segment of Weather Brains from on top of Mount Washington.
Oh, yes.
Ooh.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Our Greg Fischel went up there last summer, or actually wasn't even the summertime, and just had a blast. It was one of those bucket list items, and he just came back as giddy as a schoolgirl.
Brian, are you doing that?
The best part of this is, how in the world is Brian going to steal Wi-Fi? Yeah.
From up there, my little device will probably get Wi-Fi from, like, you know, 7,000 miles around.
He'll have to steal it from planes flying overhead, you know, just a few bits here and a few bits there.
Are you doing one of their EduTrips, Brian?
No, my daughter and I are going to go up to New Hampshire to shoot moose with our digital cameras.
Yes.
A moose once bit my sister.
There's the title.
What?
A moose shoot, once bit my sister.
To take pictures of moose.
Yeah. Wait, you're gonna shoot a moose?
No, with my camera, yes.
I thought you were going up there moose hunting.
No, moose hunting with a camera.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, and a 16-mile stretch of U.S. 3 to the Canadian line is known as has the highest density of moose per square mile anywhere in the world. I'm not sure that's true, but
title.
A moose once bit my sister.
So we're planning a trip up there, and my goal is
show title.
Yeah. Hey, there you go.
So you're gonna have to take a snowcat to get up there, then, right?
Not in June.
Oh, I thought you said in over the next couple weeks.
No, in the middle of June.
Oh, well, I'm far less impressed then.
Brian, were you a fan of Bullwinkle growing up?
Absolutely.
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a Bullwinkle out of my hat.
Hey, that was good.
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
So anyway,
part of that thing was Fractured Fairy Tales.
Oh,
I love that show. So when you say moose, I think of Bullwinkle.
I do too.
All right. Well, that's exciting stuff. All right. So let's go to Bill Murray for his pick of the week.
Yeah, James. Next week, we've got Erica Tremblay, movie producer, who's going to join us with talking about her movie Heartland, A Portrait of Survival, about the aftermath of the Joplin tornado from last year. And from 2011. That'll be fascinating. And she's going to join us. My pick tonight are the oatmeal raisin cookies that Sally brought me just a few minutes ago. And my other pick, and I'm going to go ahead and just annex Wallace Stuckey. So he's now walled off. You know, JB's got Skydaver to give him picks. Mine are going to be from Wallace Stuckey every week. He sent over two sets of picks from Minneapolis from 1965. And if you haven't gone back and listened to those clips, they're fascinating.
Actually, James has one of those up. He could play if he wanted to.
Yeah, check this out.
When you're in a hurry, use the ultimate in instant coffee. Nash's Instant Coffee, now available at Lund stores. just a minute. We have more late weather information from the WCCO Radio News
Bureau. I love this.
Yeah.
Somebody's cell phone vibrating on the desk.
The United States Weather Bureau tornado forecast for a portion of extreme north-central Iowa, most of southwest, south-central, and portions of eastern Minnesota, and a portion of northwest and west-central Wisconsin. Scattered severe thunderstorms with large hail, locally damaging winds, and the possibility of an isolated tornado are expected to occur this Thursday evening from 6 p.m. Central Standard Time until 10 p.m. Central Standard Time within an area along and 60 miles either side of a line from 30 miles northwest of Spencer, Iowa to 40 miles east of Brantsburg, Wisconsin.
The wording of that hasn't changed in 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. Area southeast of a line from Hendricks on the Minnesota-South Dakota border, northeastward to 20 miles southwest of Duluth, and north of a line from Austin to 20 miles northwest of Winona.
I'm lost already.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody understood that.
Let me hear that part where you did that.
When you're in a hurry, use the ultimate in instant coffee. Nash's Instant Coffee, now available at Lund stores. Just a minute. We have more late weather information from the WCCO Radio News Bureau.
The first recorded use of the foghorn.
It sounds like he left his pager on the desk.
Every time I go on the air for a tornado warning, I'm going to do this. And then, we have a tornado warning.
And then read a commercial.
Oh, but those are fast. And they really, they get into a point where there's a tornado on the ground on the western side of Minneapolis, and the people calling in, and it's not a lot different than today, but these people had to go to landline telephones, you know, to relay their information. And they're giving the visuals of where the tornado is and where the damage has been, and it's pretty fascinating.
To an extent, it's almost like, and I made the comment as he was reading the watch text, but it's amazing how much things change and how much they stay the same.
Exactly.
This is bad. You know, it's almost time to wrap the show up now, because now Brian is yawning, you see? Somebody started this yawning thing, and it wasn't me. It's Nate, contagious. What's your pick of the week?
My pick is the National Weather Service's preview.weather.gov enhanced or experimental data display. It's pretty cool. It's an interactive map you can pull up and chug through a bunch of different Weather Service products, including the National Digital Forecast Database. I don't know. I assume they're taking comments on it, but it looked like it'd be a lot of fun to play with it. I sort of stumbled on it this afternoon, tweeted about it, and haven't had a chance to really tinker with it. But it looked cool, and it's weather. So it's pick of the week.
Cool. All right. Who was playing Fractured Fairy Tales during the deal here?
Somebody I was. Could you hear it? I thought this didn't stream.
I heard it way in the background.
Oh, it must have been coming from...
I don't have the Fractured Fairy Tales song. I just got the Rocky and Bullwinkle song.
No, I put it in the chat.
Oh, I see it over there. Okay.
I was going to say you could use that as the outro. I didn't think you could stream without going through a bunch of hoop-de-doo to get it on this thing.
How are you getting that on the air?
The way this works, I use Audio Hijack Pro, and let me try this.
But how did Kevin do it?
He was hearing through my headphones. No, it must have been in my headphones, I guess.
Oh, okay. Because I'm jealous. I want to play sounds.
Let's see here.
It's yeah.
other than you know, bodily function sounds that Google gives.
While other James is what? Doing that, James, here's the social media corner for the week. Did you see this woman? She's a reporter, anchor reporter, or something in South Carolina, who got all wound up on Google Plus about Facebook trying to charge people that wanted to send her notes. Did you see this?
No.
It's on Google. Her name is Michelle Lee, L-I. Go look for her on Google Plus. But somebody alerted her to the fact, and you had to have known this from, I don't know, it's been a week or two or three ago, there was some discussion about sending an email to Mark Zuckerberg, and you had the opportunity to do that, but it was going to cost you $100, right?
Right.
You remember that? Yeah. Well, apparently they're doing it randomly to celebrities and people of public note, because someone alerted this woman to the fact that they were going to try and send her a note, and they played Fractured Fairy Tales instead. No, they were going to try. And a pop-up box comes up, and it says, you can send Michelle a note for $100, or you can send it to her other mailbox, which I guess is the Facebook email that they set up for everybody that nobody uses. But she had a fit because anybody that wants to send her a note and send her a story idea or anything like that was getting this notice. And, you know, the implication was that she was charging $100 for somebody to send her a note. So thank you, Facebook.
The stock price has got problems.
I mean, we need to figure out some kind of way where everybody should charge an amount to send you an email.
That's what doing.
I think somebody, a problem, huh?
See, we're all friends with James, so we can't. Somebody who's not friends with James on Facebook, try and send him a note and see if the $100 thing pops up. Because I mean,
so who gets the $100?
Facebook,
Mark Zuckerberg.
So you're saying if somebody tries to send me a message and they're not a friend, it's going to cost him $100, and I don't get any of it.
Well, we don't know. She didn't know either. Somebody alerted it to. She didn't initiate the thing. Facebook just activated it.
That sounds pretty neat. Started.
Go look for her on Google Plus. It's Michelle Lee L I. I'll find her and put it in the thing.
Yeah, get her on the show next week, Kevin.
After I take a nap.
Yeah. Can you guys hear this? Is it playing through the show? Okay. Cool.
How are you playing that?
I have never really hijacked Safari before, but it works good. This is all. Kevin sent a link in the chat about the Fractured Fairy Tales theme song here, which is by the best part of Bullwinkle. And while when we start playing stupid songs like this, it's time to wrap the show up. Weather Brains is the weekly show mostly about weather, occasionally about nothing. We record Monday nights at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. You can watch live at live.bigbrainsmedia.com.
Can't imagine why you'd want to do that.
Yeah, I'm about to say, although you might see something interesting, you never know. But,
the occasional Indian head test pattern.
That's right. The test pattern pre-show maybe was the greatest of all time tonight. We have a YouTube video version if you're listening to the recorded audio show. That's up on weatherbrains.com. The links, the show notes, the websites, the picks of the week, it's all there. And again, that is at weatherbrains.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, the email address is email@weatherbrains.com. And on behalf of the entire Weather Brains crew, I'm James Spann. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week, and God bless.